A global coalition of inaction was taking shape in space in spite of repeated warnings by MSF and over local health authorities. The WHO and the international community more generally was carefully organizing itself to not do anything against the Ebola epidemic. July 2014 was precisely the time when things should have been done but have not been done.
Yes, and a year later we learn of new cases in Liberia, which had just been declared an Ebola-free country. And these news that brought Ebola back to our global news cycle have not stopped, because just in these days we have reports of the WHO evaluation coming out, very much criticizing the way that WHO handled the Ebola outbreak in the respective countries and globally. And as we speak, we have a two-day conference happening at UN headquarters in New York, where under the Ebola recovery conference, the heads of state are meeting with large donor organizations, NGOs, to plan a two-year recovery program and trying to envision how they can, and I quote, engineer resilience in the countries most affected by the Ebola outbreak. Interestingly, in his news brief, David Navarro, the special envoy of the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, said that currently medical specialists and anthropologists are working together to end the Ebola outbreak in West Africa.
So July 2015, it's been a year also of initiatives and experimentations in the relationship between social scientists, anthropologists, historians, and humanitarian and medical responses to the Ebola outbreak. And these initiatives, experimentations, involvements have taken a lot of very different shapes, going from a silent but vital involvement of anthropologists within response teams, to more maybe patient forms of research around the response and putting the response in a broader context. So a wide range of different involvements. Some of it we have heard yesterday in a shared economics lecture. And that's precisely maybe the starting point of this roundtable, to take the time to reflect to the involvement of African studies within and outside and sometimes against the Ebola humanitarian medical response.
So we were putting together this roundtable for the conference because we thought it is not just timely but also necessary to reflect on engagement in the Ebola response, but also what this engagement could mean for researchers, but also for the larger social sciences in general. And we have come up with two general themes that we thought interesting, and maybe we here on the panel and together with you all in the audience can be discussing on them. So one is the experience of the crisis, and basically taking the Ebola epidemic as fieldwork site, the question we were pondering about is what can we learn from the involvement of anthropologists and of the social scientists in the present epidemic, beyond the classical figure of an embedded anthropologist. What kind of new relationships with medico-humanitarian interventions are evolving, what kind of personal and structural challenges and also positive outcomes are happening. The second set of themes we would like to discuss is more understanding the crisis, looking at the different temporalities and emergencies, what critical insights and new perspectives have been developed by researchers who either may have been specializing on this region or on the study of humanitarian aid or biopolitics. So to discuss these questions, we have invited four people to speak to us. We are sadly missing our fourth. We hope that you will join us soon, but we are also very happy to see very important members of this research here in the audience, and we look very much forward to hearing from you as well. And I would like to emphasize a question of language. We are speaking in English, but we are just supposing that everyone can understand French and vice versa, so we would like to encourage everyone to speak in English or in French without necessarily needing a translation, and we hope that that works. If not, we will jump into the translation. So, enough for me. We will now briefly introduce the panelists and give the word to them. Let me start with Nathaniel King, who comes to us from Sierra Leone. He is currently a consultant researcher with the World Bank's Program for Justice for the Poor. In Sierra Leone, he has been researching in and on Sierra Leone also for his PhD, which he got in Germany from the Martin Luther University, and has been my colleague for a couple of years now.
We also have Emmanuel Roth, who is a master student at SOAS, and she's currently working within a major Ebola clinical trial in Guinea.
Yeah, and Susan Scheffler, who is associate professor at the School for International Studies at the American University in Washington, and currently the George Arnold professor at the Georg Eckert Institute in Braunschweig. We're very happy that you are here with us, all three of you. We will give them 10 minutes each to give some statements and some insights, and then we invite everyone to discuss together.
And to make it a little Entara.
Entara.
University of Michigan, which is completing a doctoral research on the history, linked to the history of medicine and, in Sierra Leone. Okay? So the third part now is that we asked to introduce themselves, we asked the speakers to do it by answering 7 questions. They should be on the screen, but it's not going. So we will read you the 7 key questions they have to answer.
It's an examination.
First question, where were you when you heard about Ebola for the first time?
What was your first reaction?
Why Ebola became a concern for you?
What have you done with Ebola, and what do you think about that now?
One important thing you have understood, which you did not know before.
One important thing you thought you understood, but now realize how complex it really is.
And last question, what would you never dare to say at an Ebola roundtable?
And actually, this question goes to all of you in the audience too, so we look forward to your answer. So, let us start. Maybe with Susan?
Yes. Thank you very much. Thank you for that, for inviting me to take part. I think this is a wonderful collection of people who are coming at this from different directions, and so I look forward to a rich discussion with all of us. I'm just going to jump right into the 7 questions. Where was I when I heard about Ebola for the first time? I was actually doing a year-long Fulbright grant in Jos, Nigeria, but because I'm a long-time Sierra Leoneanist, I had research projects that were bringing me back and forth between Nigeria and Sierra Leone.
Thanks to Ben.
But at first in Nigeria, I was in an area where people eat bats. So I remember one day people had beaten the trees and the bats came down and people were happily running away with their bats. And I said, but aren't you worried about Ebola? And they said, Ebola? What? We don't understand. So my first experience was, I heard about it on the BBC, I knew about it, and the people around me didn't know anything about it. In April of 2014, I went to Sierra Leone to do some contract work and traveled around to five different districts of Sierra Leone. So you may know at this point, Ebola was in Guinea, but had not yet crossed over to Sierra Leone. And one of the places where I was doing field work was in Kailang, right on the border with Guinea. I mean, we could look across the river and see Guinea. And I encountered exactly the same lack of knowledge, lack of interest. And this is where I first started hearing, Ebola is not real, you know, this is all made up. It's a way for politicians to enrich themselves. I went back to Nigeria for a few months. My research brought me back to Sierra Leone in July and August. So by July now, Ebola had come into Sierra Leone. I was doing interviews in Freetown and in Cambia. And then I also went to Liberia and did interviews in Monrovia and Banga for a completely separate research project on education and transitional justice. And so I do these interviews with teachers, but all anybody was talking about at this point was Ebola. So just a few months later, suddenly it was all anybody could talk about. But I was still mostly hearing, we don't think this thing is real, or you know, we think that this is an American plot, we think this is bioweapons gone wrong, or we heard stories about somebody injecting people with Ebola at the hospital. So there was a lot of doubt, a lot of mistrust. And I heard so many stories about this is really politicians trying to enrich themselves. And so that's something that really stuck with me. Why would that be people's sort of first reaction to Ebola, that politicians are trying to enrich themselves? So that's where I was when I sort of first heard about it for those first few months. I then had to sort of get out of Liberia very quickly. Things changed very rapidly on the ground. My flight was canceled. I had to find another flight. I had to sort of sit inside my house for a few weeks in Freetown before I could get out. But again, even though I didn't go to do Ebola research, it was sort of all around me. And so it was a really interesting time as an anthropologist to sort of be absorbing everything that I could, what was going on the radio, what people were talking about, what my friends and family were talking about. My first reaction onto number two really was fear. Because especially from the original reactions of people, I felt like people were not taking this seriously enough. People hadn't heard about it, and I felt like I didn't know how big it was going to be, but I knew it had the potential to be big. And I was just afraid people weren't taking it seriously enough. Why did Ebola become a concern for me? Because Sierra Leone is my home. and I was worried about the future of Sierra Leone. And the region generally, but it was a very emotional thing for me too. So even when I then went back to the United States, I think, you know, I spent months in depression sort of following the Ebola news obsessively, as many of us did, and trying to get funds to go back to Sierra Leone. Luckily, there was a group of anthropologists who organized around this. I remember running into people who I know who work in this field and sharing with them my sense of, God, I wish we could do something. I wish there was something we could do. And a group came together. Anita came to this event in Washington, D.C., that tried to talk about ways that anthropologists could make our knowledge useful to the humanitarian efforts. Because a lot of what we were hearing were things like, we don't understand why people won't just follow the rules. You know, they've got the guidelines. Why are they not following the guidelines on burials? And most us anthropologists were like, well, of course, there's good reasons for that. And so this sort of goes into number four. What have you done with Ebola, and what do you think about that now? I mean, I tried to engage in this new way of doing anthropology, or new way of thinking about doing almost emergency anthropology, which required packaging our knowledge in easily digestible memos and so on for humanitarians to use. And some of that worked through UNMEER, who realized early on that they needed anthropological knowledge, and so they were, you know, asking us all the time for little, you know, quick, does anybody know about this region? Does anybody know about this? I'm sorry, UNMEER is the UN Ebola response agency. So basically when the WHO wasn't doing its job, the UN did an ad hoc UN Ebola agency. And I don't remember exactly what it stands for. UN Medical Ebola Emergency Response.
Exactly.
So I tried to work on that stuff with the anthropologists. It was hard, it was ad hoc, it was fast. Anita was involved in that too. It was really, Sharon Abramowitz was the person who really spearheaded it. In addition, I did tons of media. I don't know about other people here, but I got asked to do interviews all the time. And I'm not sure if that was the right thing to do or not either, because in some ways I feel like I fed into the hysteria, even though my message always I tried to make my message always be, it's not about you people in America and Ebola coming here. Think about the people who are dying in Sierra Leone. Think about what we can do for people in West Africa. And we really need to work together with them rather than impose our solutions on them, which I think I've been saying throughout. So that's kind of the second thing I did was media, and I'm ambivalent about how that went. The third thing I did was, together with a public health colleague at my university, we got some funds to go to Sierra Leone. We tried to go in October. My university blocked us from going because they were afraid we would bring Ebola back to the university. This was at the peak of the hysteria. We kept trying. Eventually, they let us go in January. But even then, when we came back, they wouldn't let us on campus for 21 days after that. And the goal of that trip was that, because I have long-standing relationships there, and she's a public health person, and she knew CDC people who were posted there, we thought we could maybe do something to help do that translation thing that needed to happen, right? Try to explain to CDC people on the ground, this is what Sierra Leone is all about. It was a lot harder than we thought it would be. So I'm happy that we did it. I learned a lot about it from my own research going forward. I'm not sure how successful it was, this model of rapid, interdisciplinary, you know, scholarly intervention. So that was number four. Number five, one important thing you've understood, which you did not know before. I think, what do I want to say here? And then there's also one thing you didn't know before. One thing I didn't know before was how quickly Sierra Leonean and Liberian culture could change. Yeah. I think early on, when they said, you know, nobody should shake hands anymore, I thought, that's never going to happen. Sierra Leoneans, I mean, shaking hands is a central part of the culture. And yet, within a couple weeks, people stopped. And that really surprised me. I thought I knew Sierra Leone, and that's something that really surprised me, how quickly people were able to change something that I thought was so central. I think I've understood also a little bit more the kind of lack of lessons learned from the past. I mean, one of the things I saw was the echoes of the post-war period, and I thought that we would have learned more from that, and I see now that we have not necessarily. And that there's something produced by that kind of constant new emergency way of doing things, and the kind of productivity of that. How far am I now? I'm done with him. Done. One thing I thought I knew but realize now is more complex is the relationship between the state and its people. Because I think, like I said early on, they were like, this is just politicians trying to enrich themselves. And then at a certain point, the state was exactly where people looked for help. So this is sort of a contradictory, like, the state can't do anything, and oh my God, we need the state. So that was new and interesting to me. And so finally, what would I never dare to say at an Ebola roundtable? are exactly these doubts of whether we can contribute in the emergency moment. I mean, I think we all sort of jump in saying we must be able to do something. I've come away feeling like I'm not sure how possible it is. I should be all rah-rah for the importance of anthropological engagement, but I'm not sure that I can be. Thank you.
My examination begins now. Question one. I'm a pretty old-fashioned person. What does it have to do with Ebola? You learn in a moment. I have this ability of carrying around radios and listening to the news, what's coming in and what's old and all of that. But thankfully, there's something called a mobile phone now, which one could have plugged into the ears to find out what is going on in the world. So I've been following the news about the good, the bad, and the ugly in the world stage for quite a while. And I've come to learn about Ebola from some time past. And then I was teaching my students, but I gave them some very difficult work to do. And then I took some time out to get back to listening to the radio. And then I learned about the possible entrance of Ebola into Liberia, because people were beginning to have, the expression was flu-like symptoms. And then I said to myself, oh my God, the bad guy has entered. And I said this because I knew what I'd heard from how stubborn the disease was in its presence and spread in other parts of Africa. And it was unthinkable that there would have been that leap from the east to the west. But it happened. But I didn't tell my students, otherwise I could have generated some heat out there. So that was how I first learned about the disease. Question two. I've already spoken about my reaction. I said the bad guy had entered. But how did Ebola become a concern for you? Maybe I need to say something about my name here. Forgive me for bringing the discussion back to me. My name is Nathaniel King. So it became a concern for me when somebody treated me like royalty. It was a colleague of mine at the university. I extended my hand to shake his hand, and he refused the handshake and bowed down to me. In the 21st century, bowing down to a king. Then I said to myself, this must be a concern. I know my hand was left hanging there. And I said, whatever this was, it was really scary. I had to find a way to wipe my hand against my trousers because it was hanging for too long sometime. He bowed, and many other people bowed to me. The king has become a king because of Ebola, probably. And what have you done with Ebola? Well, thankfully, I am a consultant for the World Bank, but surprise, surprise, I do not work with the health sector directly. I work with extractives, industry, and education and other areas. But once upon a time, the managing director of the World Bank in Sierra Leone recognized that there was a social anthropologist in-house. And then he took his time out to leave the spaciousness and the beauty of his office to go down to my not-so-cozy office and chatted me about the value that I could contribute towards understanding the Ebola spread. That was the time when we had double figures returned every day, and it was becoming a concern for the bank. So I was engaged to ask questions about why people did the way they did things against what the government was saying, and why they did not do things that they were asked to do. So, but I, being the curious anthropologist I was and still am, I decided to broaden the study a bit to ask, what good have people done in country to stop the disease? So hence my research paper, which is a World Bank property, but which I can briefly share with you, should you be interested. And I call that in-country best practices and why people tended the sick and washed the dead. And that became a signature paper that affected and directed policy afterwards. So, and you asked about how I think about those interventions now. Well, the research was somewhat limited because I'm a scared person. for the first time in my life, I carried out a telephone research because I didn't want to get to the hotspot. So, but the quality of the research that came out of it, well, it cost a lot of money to buy credits and the rest, but I got the valuable information that I wanted, and that became the policy guide. So some of the findings I would straight to indicate here, and I wonder whether that could be applied elsewhere. One of the standout findings was that Ebola was spreading because people did not have the opportunity to give the dead respectable burials. So there was a recommendation coming from the people that there should be residual ritual burials after the disease. So people felt that if there were to be that residual provision for proper burial, they would be free to surrender their bodies to the government for burial. So I made that recommendation and the government espoused it, although it was never traced back to me, but I don't mind that because it was for my country and for the fighting of the disease. And the second was, quarantine was being a scary and maybe made a scary animal. Nobody wanted to go into quarantine voluntarily. So one of the things to do to make quarantine desirable was to make people to have all that they required when they were in quarantine. Food, relaxation, even possible to watch television and the like. When quarantine became respectable and desirable, people willingly surrendered themselves to that. And when I was happy to see how the positives of that came out. So, and there were many other things. I recognize also that when there are structures set within a community that works against disease, it works better than the impositions from above coming from NGOs, the World Bank, for example, the GIZ. When there are recognitions that internally there are mechanisms that could fight disease, that helps, and it did help. Now, question five. One important thing that I understand now that I never knew I'd understand was that a disease had the paradoxical potentials to be a unifier and a divider. In spite of the repulsions that a disease could convey, the disease united Sierra Leoneans against a common enemy. But on the other hand, after the country had become relatively safe from the disease, when people contracted the disease, either by laxity or other purpose, they were refused to be recognized as Sierra Leoneans. It was as if the blame was again externalized, because we have succeeded in fighting it. So you who brought it, you must be a foreigner from somewhere else besides the community. One thing you thought you understand, but now recognize how complex it is. I'd always thought that the disease had a fine entry and could always have a fine exit. But I willingly surrender to my ignorance on this. It is a very, very tough fighter. And what would I dare not to say in a round table like this? Well, I dare not to say, but I'm forced to say because it's an examination question, and I have to be marked, that Ebola fights very, very hard. Killing it is an easy part, but keeping it dead is the more difficult part. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is it extensible?
No.
Oh, whoa. Okay, come.
So thank you to Anita and you for inviting me to this roundtable. And of course, I'm talking from a slightly different perspective because I am hopefully beginning what is going to be a long career as an anthropologist, but I'm a beginner. So I began with Ebola, and that's basically my story. So about how Ebola became a concern for me and how I got involved with the epidemic. I had thought about starting my PhD work in Guinea and to work on community health. And so early in 2014, I read about the epidemic in the international coverage on Guinea. And so my first reactions were first a certain amount of worry for the friends I had met there in the years before, but then curiosity and some level of excitement as well, because I felt that my research, the research I had planned, would be much more relevant and would attract much more interest from policymakers and researchers alike. So I had intended to conduct fieldwork in Guinea in August 2014, so exactly a year ago. And as
July approached, so when the case rate skyrocketed and the hotspots slowly started to extend to neighboring countries, I slowly started reconsidering my project to conduct this preparatory fieldwork, which was really much of a freelance project. I was working with nobody, basically. And this is when Ebola became a concern, not only for me, but also for my university, my supervisors, and my family. So most were concerned about my safety, of course, because I really wanted to go. I thought it was important to be there. I also questioned my own desire to go there as a budding anthropologist. I was not sure it would be very legitimate, it would be very useful. And then a couple of days before going, before my departure, I decided against going because I thought that it would not be very easy to access health centers and care workers, and they would have other things on their mind than talking to me. So what I'm aiming at is that Ebola was framed at the beginning for me as helped me frame very important questions for me as a student of anthropology. I thought, how far can I go? How far can I go for a PhD? How far can I go for my career? Because Ebola also represents an opportunity for all of us, people working in the region and those sort of issues. And how far can I go? Which risk can I take as an anthropologist? So in the end, I did go in December 2014, so 3 or 4 months later. And those months, I had the time to embody the security measures, this feeling of safety through reading a lot about the mode of transmission, and then also spreading the word to my family and telling them about how it was transmitted and to my university as well. So then, what have I done with Ebola? And how do I think about that now? So in 2014, I worked as part of a team of anthropologists involved in the implementation of clinical trials of an antiviral named Favipiravir, which was implemented by the French Institute for Medical Research. So our aim was supposed to be to assist community involvement and acceptability of the trial, and we were mainly supposed to conduct participant observation in Ebola treatment centers. So we became involved in psychosocial aspects of care, communication about the trials, outreach, working with group of survivors. Now, there are two ways of, I think, thinking about that now in retrospect. So from an academic perspective, I think at that time, so as a researchers team, we were in a very unique position to conduct research from a slightly different angle, because the framework we adopted to understand Ebola was very much more influenced by political anthropology and STS, so science and technology studies, than maybe African studies. And the research results which were expected from us revolved around the practice of science in emergency, including anthropology. So I believe we were very reflexive as researchers, but this reflexivity did not prevent us from raising, from contributing to the disease containment efforts, because being free to observe things without the constraints of a framework of a demand from WHO or from MSF, we were able to raise a different voice. So we, among other things, we recommended grave marking in Gekedu. We alerted the WHO to deficiencies in the standard of care, and acted as interlocutors of humanitarian actors. But from a personal perspective, how do I think about that now? To be honest, when I talk about it now to people, I start by saying it was one of the most intense period of my whole short life. We were thrilled. I think I wasn't the only one. The care workers were also thrilled to participate to this, what they saw as a fight against the disease. And every day was filled with, from 6 a.m. to 10 to 11 p.m., with stories of rumors, of killings, of community resistances or jealousy. So we all felt that we were taking part in some historical moment whatsoever. So that was really interesting to be part of it. I'd like to then address what would I never dare to say at an Ebola roundtable, because the picture I've just given of our action, I'm not sure it really does reflect the reality. I share your doubts, Nathaniel and Susan. A lot has been said about the importance and the advantages of embedding anthropologists into the response. A lot of NGOs resorted to consultancy work, countless reports about what cultures could contribute or how cultures could be changed. Was all this useful? I think there'll be no way to know. And I think that if we were useful, it might not have been as anthropologists, as researchers, because we were not working within the tempus of emergency. We are still going, our team is still going to Guinea. We'll still keep on working on Ebola in the next 2 years. We had no pressure to act, and if we were useful, I think it was mainly in the chinks, in the interstices, how we say in French, meaning as in the small interactions with care workers, talking about love or family, allowing them to give a different story of their work against Ebola. And so it's mainly in those spaces that I think we contributed, because we humanized, I mean, we as white outsiders, we contributed to some sort of humanization of the work itself, maybe not of the results. And so I think there's a problem with the efficacy that is asked of anthropologists. Some people were hired by MSF to work as psychologists or community mobilizers, which introduced themselves as anthropologists, which might have used some of the tools of anthropology, but that doesn't make them anthropologists. I might not be an anthropologist myself, but at least I recognize it. So one important thing I have understood, which I did not know before, and I'd like to address that question in relationship with one important thing I thought I knew, but I now realize how complex it is. So anthropologists were called for to prevent resistances and misunderstandings. So I was expecting resistances and misunderstandings when I went to Guinea. In relation to the clinical trials, I envisioned so many different scenarios of anger, mistrust, and fear for the whites who are now taking some liberties to test new chemicals with very uncertain effects. And the anthropology of global health also thrives on the analysis of such episodes of violence, rumors, incidents, misunderstanding. But what I have understood is how much people can take in without showing too much discontent, and in good faith. There was not that much resistance in the end, and it did not take, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 months before the majority of community burials were secured and the majority of contacts were followed up. So I think this raises questions as to our expectations as anthropologists critical of global health, because this paradox flips over the task which is usually asked of us. I think instead of explaining misunderstandings here, we were left wondering why, in appearance, the compliance and the understanding was so high, or were there some working misunderstanding? It might also be that I was not experienced enough, and the context of the trial is very important to understand. The trial did not operate as a form of triage. There was no randomized. It was not randomized, but it was experienced as a gift of care, of a new treatment, and not. It's over. So I think that's it. So maybe just one conclusion about the new relationships that have emerged. I had initially intended to recount how we worked as a team of researchers in combination with clinicians. And I think this is not the classic figure of the embedded anthropologist, because there was a lot of trust between people, clinicians, and anthropologists who are used to working together for almost one decade already on HIV. So there was trust and some understanding, but then the collaboration was very limited because clinicians were interested in some things and they knew what they were interested in and what they were not interested in. And we also used them. There was also some utilitarianism in it. We used clinicians to access some fields and then to be able to produce papers, articles, and talks, and engage with the researchers community. And as much as possible, also to engage with humanitarian actors. But this this is not very easy, to say the least.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me. I've written my comments down because otherwise I'll ramble on. So I'm just going to go straight through and answer the questions as well. So I honestly don't remember where I was the first time that I heard about Ebola having been found in West Africa, but I remember my reaction. And my first reaction was to be completely stunned. I thought, Ebola? This is a thing of the past. This is a thing of 1970s Congo. This is a nightmare disease where everybody dies. Are you kidding me? It's got to be wrong. This is misdiagnosed Lassa fever. This will all be over in a few weeks. It can't be the truth. You know, I had just this sheer disbelief. And then, so the second question about how it became a concern for me is both how and why. This happened in stages. The first concern began when the disease crossed the border, so when it came into Sierra Leone. It came through Kailaun. My family is from Kailaun, and while I no longer have direct relations living in that district, to have one's ancestral home turf serve as the entry point for yet another catastrophe, to quote one of Guillaume's pieces, was distressing. Not surprising, again, thanks to Guillaume, but distressing. This Tri-Points area that you've pointed out in your work is just such a notoriously permeable non-border area. I wasn't surprised, just distressed. Here it is, Kailaun again. The second stage was when a World Health Organization official, upon visiting the area in June 2014, pronounced the situation not out of control. What does that mean? Not out of control. Does that mean it's under control? That was incredibly concerning. In addition to, you know, as a clinician, I have a background as a registered nurse. I worked in maternal child health for 10 years. So thinking about the high probability of this disease just blowing up, I couldn't imagine how such a knowledgeable, ostensibly knowledgeable organization could be blowing this off. It was very distressing and completely at odds with everything I had been hearing from MSF on the ground, who were at that point crying for additional staff. So not out of control. So the third stage was in late July, when first the Owoko, which is a Freetown newspaper, and then Umaro Fofana, who is a wonderful, if you don't follow him on Twitter, you should, reporter in Freetown, reported that a pregnant woman suspected of having contracted EVD, Ebola virus disease, had escaped Princess Christian Maternity Hospital, which is the national referral hospital for obstetric emergencies, and disappeared into the east end of the capital. This was when I began to completely despair. I remember calling my dad, and I was like, Dad, Ebola's in Freetown. And we were just silent. I knew if and when the virus hit Freetown, it would spread exponentially. And I had been hoping against hope that somehow it would be held at bay. I was scared. I was very scared. I was scared for my family living in the heart of Freetown, and I was very scared, especially given the nature of where this outbreak started in Freetown, at the hospital where I studied, massive exchange of bodily fluids with a woman who was presenting bleeding and vomiting, and then leaving, I thought, oh my God, who was on duty that night? Who was there? Are they safe? What's happening? And I remember also at that point being outraged as the Ministry of Health, are there Ministry of Health officials here? Ministry of Health claimed that the woman had been tested and was negative. And this proved to be false 4 days later when she died in an ambulance en route to the hospital. And that was how Ebola came to Freetown. So what I have done with Ebola, what I have done with Ebola is not enough. My first impulse, well, one of my first impulses was to get on a plane and help. I'm a nurse, I can help, I can start IVs, you know, I can help. I spent months obsessing over going to help. How could I sit in safe, comfortable Michigan when I could be there helping? I have to go, I have to help. For lots of reasons, including my two young children and my teaching job as a graduate student, I was prevented from going, and I regret this viscerally even today. I still want to go. It's a huge regret. I've sent money to family and friends, maybe more than usual. I've participated in the UNMEER listserv that Susan was referencing, and I put myself on the radar of an anthropologist, a medical anthropologist who is coordinating information collected in the affected countries and sort of funneling that back to the World Health Organization and now DFID and one other organization. And I was hopping up and down saying, I know this hospital's been my life for the last 8 years. I can help. Yeah. Nobody asked me any questions. I could have helped, you know, I regret that. And I have used the epidemic as a teaching opportunity because I was stuck in Michigan teaching. I was going to teach Ebola. I happened to be teaching a course on the history of medicine in the fall of 2014, and I can happily report that my students left with more knowledge about structural adjustment and British colonial health policy than any History 284 student ever before. How much time do I have, Guillaume? I have a really interesting story about the FBI showing up at my door. Okay, I'll wait for that. Okay. I have also clearly identified my next research project. Done deal. Absolutely. I skipped question five. You said we could skip a question. I skipped question five. So what did I think I know before that is now more complex? So I thought I knew where I stood on the white savior complex and on NGO tourism, but this epidemic has really complicated these issues for me, and the issue of humanitarian aid in general. Sierra Leone could not have done this without a massive amount of help. So what to do with this as someone who has critiqued these responses and the saviors from the north with the white coats coming. I'm still sorting this out. What I would never say at an Ebola roundtable is that I believe that the role of racism and racial prejudice is a black cloud hovering over responses, both humanitarian responses and social responses within the United States and other countries that just has not been addressed sufficiently. Someone needs to think about this more. Much like I think it played a huge role in the delayed response to the epidemic. So much like the epidemic of police killing of unarmed black men in the United States, it took a highly visible, undeniably horrifying event to bring both best and the worst in race relations out between sub-Saharan Africa and the global north. It wasn't until the virus affected American citizens that the United States government truly committed to helping. And though British Airways flights to and from Freetown have resumed, passengers arriving from Sierra Leone continue to be sprayed with disinfectant before they are permitted to touch British soil, just as they were for decades before the great Ebola epidemic of 2014.